I think it's probably a good thing that this meeting comes at the end of a week of terror in South Vietnam. I know I was much shocked by it. I'm sure you were. It's hard to know what one can say about the events of the past week. My own reaction is one of horror at the terrible slaughter, of awe at the amazing heroism of those who are officially designated as our enemies, of guilt that we still permit this horror to continue. Even now, even after this week, no one doubts that in some hideous sense of the word, the United States can still obtain a victory, can still win in Vietnam. But if the men in Washington are still at all rational, they must realize that this can only be a victory of the graveyard. The only possible American victory is the one that was described a couple of weeks ago by the editor of the Vietnam Guardian, one of the many journals suppressed by the Saigon government. He said, "You cannot defeat the other side militarily unless you devote the next 30 or 40 years to it. You can win if you keep killing for a generation. You simply exterminate all the Vietnamese, the way you killed the Indians in America, and there will be no more war." There's no reason to doubt that this assessment is accurate, and I suppose that Washington must understand that. But if we're going to be thinking at all seriously about tactics, about actions that might contribute to ending this war, short of absolute annihilation, we'd better try to understand the mood in Washington, not get wrapped up in romantic delusions that come from talking to one another too much, and try to capture the mood to react properly to the mood in the country as well. Unfortunately, we have a president who probably represents pretty accurately the mainstream of American opinion, although people in the peace movement don't like to believe this. I don't like to believe it either, but I'm afraid that Lyndon Johnson probably does reflect prevailing American attitudes when he says, as he did, that without superior air power, America is a bound and throttled giant, impotent and easy prey to any yellow dwarf with a pocket knife. What is important about such statements is not so much the undercurrent of racism, though that's bad enough, but rather the idea that we are prey to these yellow dwarves with their pocket knives. Obviously, we are easy prey to them only in their countries, where we have a perfect right to be. Secretary McNamara, the well-known dove, takes essentially the same position, although he does it with a little bit more grace and subtlety. In his farewell testimony this week, which is well worth reading, he states that we are fighting in Vietnam, a quote, "to preserve the principle that political change must not be brought about by externally directed violence and military force." That's political change that must not be brought about by violence and force. Of course, political stability on our terms may be brought about by externally directed violence and military force, as we're now doing. And of course, he goes on even beyond that to imply that we, uniquely of course, have even the right to use our violence to carry out military and social, political and social change. So he says, I quote again, "Pacification involves nothing less than the restructuring of Vietnamese society." Pacification, which of course for a year has been under the direction of the American military, close to a year. "The principle that we're fighting for then is not the principle of non-intervention in the internal affairs of other countries, no old-fashioned nonsense like that, but rather the principle that the United States has the role of international judge and executioner, and that it alone has that principle." These are what Secretary McNamara's words mean, and they are in fact what he states when you listen to them carefully and you pay attention to their implications. McNamara also, I'm sure the Viet Cong will be glad to hear this, he explains that we do not seek the surrender of the Viet Cong forces. We would be content to see them lay down their arms. That's a quotation. I have to say that this is censored testimony, and probably in the uncensored part he explains the difference between surrendering and laying down your arms, but I don't know about that. Now, of course, it's easy to make fun of idiotic pronouncements like this, but amusement fades when you begin to calculate the human cost, or when you begin to realize that the spectrum of responsible opinion extends all the way over from Secretary Rusk on the one hand to McNamara on the other, McNamara, who takes for granted that we alone among the nations of the world have the authority to decide what are the legitimate elements in Vietnamese society and to use our incredible military force to impose on Vietnam the institutions that we, in our wisdom and benevolence, have designed for them. Why do we have this right? The answer has been given by a great many statesmen and scholars. We have this right because it is in our national interest. Our president has expressed the matter quite clearly when he said, quote, "There are 3 billion people in the world, and we have only 200 million of them. We are outnumbered 15 to 1. If might did make right, they would sweep over the United States and take what we have. We have what they want. We're going to have to stand and say, might doesn't make right, as we're doing in South Vietnam, for example, or in Guatemala, say, where, according to the Vice President Rojas, American planes based in Panama have been carrying out napalm raids against villages suspected of harboring rebels." That's a quote from Le Monde. Those of you who are so benighted that you're reading is restricted to the American press would not know of this statement by the Guatemalan vice president. When President Johnson pleads that we're defending ourselves from a superior force and that we must stand in Vietnam or else they will sweep over the United States and take what we have, when he says these things, he is unfortunately representing a substantial and, in fact, probably dominant body of American opinion. To us, it seems hard to imagine that 30 years ago, enlightened German opinion could believe that there was a Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy that was threatening the survival of Germany, the bearers of the spiritual values of Western civilization. To others, it may be equally difficult to take seriously the picture of the strongest, richest country in the world, cowering in terror behind its nuclear missiles and atomic warheads, in fear that what we have will be taken away if we allow a tiny country halfway around the world to follow its own course in freedom from American domination. But if we want to think realistically about America and what we ought to be doing in America, then we'd better bear in mind that this is a pretty accurate characterization. We'd also better bear in mind that this is a country where a leading liberal commentator, after all that's happened in the past 3 years, can still describe the American war in Vietnam in these terms. America is fighting a war now on the principle that military power shall not compel South Vietnam to do what it does not want to do, that man does not belong to the state. This is the deepest conviction of Western civilization. As I've just pointed out, we're not the first nation to have seen itself as fighting to defend the deepest convictions of Western civilization. And when James Reston, who that was a quotation from, can describe what we're doing in Vietnam in these terms, then we can see what a long road lies ahead before there's any hope that this country will recover its political sanity. This is the context in which we have to ask about what we're going to do in connection with draft resistance and other things. It goes without saying that inquiry, protest, educational efforts must continue and intensify, but dissent, everyone would agree, must be coupled with political action. What means of political action are open to us? Unfortunately, the political system simply is incapable of coming to grips with issues of war and peace. We may wish that this were otherwise, but facts can't be wished out of existence, and it is a fact, a remarkable fact, that in this democracy, there is not a single public figure, there is no segment of the mass media that is willing to advocate or even seriously to consider what is the dominant opinion of mankind, including the so-called free world, namely that the United States should put an end to its aggression and withdraw from Vietnam. As long as that remains the case, it's simply pointless and silly to think about political action against the war. The political issues are not arising and therefore there's nothing that one could do about them, even granted that we could do about them something about them, were they to enter the political arena. And that's not obvious. In fact, the only form of political action that's open to an American citizen today, an American citizen who opposes American wars of aggression, is some form of resistance, I'm afraid. Now, resistance is often discussed in terms of moral responsibility, and I think this is quite proper. It's quite fair. It certainly is a moral responsibility to avoid complicity in criminal acts and to support those who are courageous enough to refuse to be the agents of government terror. But it should not be overlooked that resistance is also a political act. It's an act that raises the domestic cost of American aggression and that therefore poses certain conditions that anyone must face who makes the decisions to continue with this aggression. This is true in a country that does regard aggression as legitimate when it's not too costly. One has to think in these terms, whether one likes it or not. There are many respects in which one could exemplify this. I don't want to even bother spelling out the details because I think they're obvious. Take the case of graduate students. The government's got to decide within the next couple of months what to do about graduate students. They put off the decision for a year. If they exempt them, then the draft resistance people have a very effective organizing tool, I think, for that may be able to let them reach into working class, lower middle class neighborhoods. To point out clearly, it'll be then perfectly obvious that this is a war that the rich can buy their way out of. I don't think that the government is going to allow that tool to be used. I think it's probably politically difficult or impossible in an election year, at least, to give a blanket exemption to students. On the other hand, if they do not, if they decide to draft students, it's possible that they might run up against very serious resistance, that the government will be forced to carry out repressive acts against the socioeconomic elite, the leaders of the next generation. And that's a very different matter from shooting down people in the streets of Detroit and Newark. This is really costly. And furthermore, I think that we have to recognize that one of the costs of the war, a cost that I'm sure they're well aware of in Washington, is just the disaffection, just the contempt for the government that is more and more widespread among young people. I have no doubt that repression and punishment of those who refuse to take part in war crimes can only deepen this disaffection, and by doing so can increase in a very serious and significant way, I think, the cost of this and maybe future wars. And it goes without saying that adult support in any form, direct involvement, will increase substantially the cost of repression, hence the political value of these acts. If those who are here and others like them in other cities, if we're willing to give part of our incomes and part of ourselves, I hope that's increasing order of importance, to this effort, then I think it can be a very powerful force, one that shouldn't be underestimated. Now, there are a lot of things that can be said about the more long-range significance of resistance. I don't think that it has to be thought of simply as a negative act directed against this war. If we think about the kind of country we live in, the kind of role it plays in the world, then I think we can easily see why we can hope, at least, we can try to look for ways to turn this movement of resistance into a weapon that will go beyond a nucleus of action will go beyond trying to put a stop to this war before it leads to annihilation of the Vietnamese or something worse. There are many aspects of this situation that could be discussed. One that I think is particularly frightening is simply the enormous coverage that's given to the atrocities that are committed in the war. Of course, the people who are involved in the peace movement do their share in increasing the exposure to these atrocities. And through them, quite without their efforts, through the mass media, we're absolutely saturated with evidence of American war crimes. This is undoubtedly the first war in history where any country has exposed its own war crimes on the front pages and in the television. Well, it wasn't television before. Now, you know, on the surface, this looks like a sign of the democratic free character of the society, but probably all it is a sign of the fact that nobody cares about these things as long as we're doing them. And in fact, the more we have this saturation, the greater the danger is in a very serious sense. This impact on the American public of the vast coverage of these events I think is very frightening in its implications. It can lead to a kind of habituation to atrocity, to a raising of the level at which one gets shocked, that could be a very fearful thing, and I think points to what may be the real long-range significance of the kind of resistance that's now in its incipient stages. This sort of resistance is forcing us to confront the most important issue that can possibly exist in the world dominant power, in the country that by any objective standards is the most aggressive and expansionist in the world. This resistance is forcing us to be aware of our own passive complicity, and it's engaging us in a struggle against an otherwise inevitable accommodation to still greater and unending violence. American power is, in fact, so overwhelming that there is no one in the world who can call us to account. The responsibility to do so lies on American citizens, on us, and on us alone. Quite apart from these long-range issues, I think if we think merely in terms of immediate political impact, immediate political effectiveness, then a very strong argument can be given that support for resistance does constitute the most effective way for a citizen to raise the domestic cost of American aggression in this war and to make his own personal contribution to ending it, or at least limiting it. Probably, and we should not forget this, at great cost to himself. Personally, I believe that if American democracy does survive this crisis, then the Fort Hood 3 and the Boston 5 and other people like them will be recognized as the people who struggled to save humanistic and democratic ideals in the face of the apathy and the ignorance and the moral cowardice of the society as a whole. But I do want to emphasize the word ultimately. Ultimately may be a long way off, and ultimate vindication may be little comfort for those who will suffer for their commitment to the values that we all pretend to hold. It's up to the rest of us to make sure that this is not so, to stand beside them in their effort to bring this war to an end and to save our own country from becoming an object of hatred and contempt for civilized mankind. This, I think, is the problem that we face today, that we should be thinking about at what is a critical and what may be a desperate moment in American history.